Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning. I'm Stephanie Curtis. This is NPR News, and this is a big week for food. As families gather for holiday traditions, new and old. So this hour, we're going to listen to a roundtable recorded all about Minnesota food traditions. It was recorded in Moorhead, Minnesota, as part of our 50th anniversary celebration. And maybe it'll inspire some culinary adventures for you this holiday weekend.
Good morning from Moorhead, Minnesota. I'm Carrie Miller. This is Minnesota Public Radio News, and we're on the road and doing the show from the Roark Art Gallery Museum. This is part of Minnesota Public Radio's 50th anniversary celebration, and we have a live audience. I just want to describe this beautiful space that we're in. I had a tour before we went on the air. We're in an old post office, and the woodwork and the huge windows and the space is full of light, and we're surrounded with these beautiful paintings and photography, and whoever came up with this idea, thank you. This is like the perfect place to be in Moorhead. So thank you all for coming this morning. We're going to have a conversation today about foods of the Northland and what it means to a family and a community to gather around a table. What are the tastes and the experiences that are unique to this part of the state? I know there are some foodies in the audience because I think I've met everybody that's here. So I expect you to chime in, I hope, with your thoughts on this. I want to talk about how food has defined northern Minnesota. And we have four guests. And then I've got a question for the audience here to think about. Amy Thielen is with us. She's a chef and a writer. Her newest memoir is titled Give a Girl a Knife. Good to see you again.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Andrea Baumgartner is the chef and co-owner of Burn Bombs. It's a restaurant bagel shop in Fargo that everybody here has been raving about to me. She grew up around here. She came back after working in restaurants in L.A. and San Francisco. We're going to dig into that, Andrea. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
Bruce Engerbrentson runs a craft studio near here, grew up in the area, is a foodie, knows a lot about food history. Bruce, welcome. Good to have you here. And Bud Parker is retired Navy, and historian, man of all things and many skills and talents, right? Is that fair to say?
I don't know.
Welcome. Good to have you here. So, Amy, I was paging back through the new Midwestern table, and I think something that you said really fits our discussion today. You said a lot of the best Midwestern food involves a very American intimacy with the wilderness. Tell me how you think about that.
Yeah, I think that that's thinking about like what defines Midwestern food, and I do think that it's the hunting and gathering, those traditions that exist today, and we're always here. Because when I, you know, went back to write that book, I'm like, what is Midwestern food? You know, it's a big question. It's hard, and it's always shifting. And really, the answer, I think, is that it was the food of everybody who came here, brushing up against the food that was already here and the native traditions that were here, and then everybody joining in and going out to get the harvests. And so when everybody started, like, you know, hunting, picking wild berries, getting nuts, Bruce and Bud and I were talking about wild hazelnuts yesterday, you know, then that became all of our food, wild rice, all the things that grow naturally here.
Bruce, I'm thinking, though, in some ways this is a romanticized version of the way we eat, isn't it? I don't hunt and gather. How many people actually hunt and gather for what they're eating here every day? I think we like to think that that's the way we eat. What would you say about that?
I would say lately that things are changing.
Okay.
They definitely are. And somehow, though, we can't let the perfect be the enemy of the good.
Meaning?
If we're going to have a Minnesota cuisine or a Midwestern cuisine, what's going to be part of that? Are blueberry pancakes going to be something that speaks to you of Minnesota?
Yes.
Or walleye?
Oh. Okay, walleye.
So things definitely, no. People do not pick berries like they used to. People do not. When I was growing up, maybe we were a bit backward, but man, anytime that we heard there was something for free, something somewhere food that yeah. you could put away for free. We were, oh, there's a plum tree in the refuge. They said, oh, yeah, okay, well, we all went and we got plums. And then, and I think that with berries, I try and pick a quart of wild strawberries every year. And they're small. They're about the mm-hmm. size of a pea. But I try and get one quart for my Santa Lucia Day party. And I told my auntie, who's in her 90s.
She's the best party, by the way.
Yeah. My auntie in her 90s, I said, oh, well, Eleanor, I got a quart, and that's my goal. And she said, oh, yeah, she said. And she's very, very Scandinavian in that she doesn't try to wave her own flag, but she said kind of in an offhanded way, I always used to get 20 quarts of those.
Ah, okay. Andrea, what about this idea of, you know, kind of where the romanticized version of intimacy with the wilderness meets reality?
For me, I think it's what's interesting to me is that I think of it more as like farm cuisine.
Okay.
I think of my grandmas were good farm cooks, like probably everyone's grandma who's in here, and partially because they had to be. And there was also a really interesting, which I think is part of the hunting and gathering, but there was a really interesting focus on doing with what you had, which I think we don't have anymore.
It's kind of a scarceness?
Yeah, as strictures almost.
This.
You know, yeah. When you looked at, like, you had to deal with the seasons. You had to deal with not the best kitchen, perhaps. You had to deal, and even actually in our restaurant, we've accidentally recreated that in that we don't have a complete commercial kitchen. And so,
okay, wait a minute. What do you mean by that? You accidentally recreated
well,
that?
Well, we ended up opening a restaurant in a space that is not a commercial kitchen space, and uh-huh. so we talked to the city, and they said, well, this is what you can sort of get away with, and we wanted to try out the bagel idea, so we did, and what we have is an electric four-burner range that we bought at Restore, which is the Habitat for Humanity store, for $70, and we have one commercial electric oven in back, and we have a couple fridges.
It sounds like, yeah.
And so we do sometimes, we have a couple pieces of commercial equipment that we're allowed to have, but we're limited. And we certainly, like, by the size of the menu, by what we can cook, by what we can chill every day.
Right.
And for me, that's actually been really useful. And when people come in and bring me wild plums or, you know, at first I do have a moment of terror where I think, oh, no.
What am I going to do? Now I have to do something with this.
Right. But then you make jam. And then you think, oh, I can throw it in the freezer. I can.
Yeah, I want to develop this idea that, again, Amy and I have talked about the fulfillment of scarceness, right? And that's a seasonal thing, right? Right now, there's plenty.
Right.
But we're coming into a season where that won't be the case. And that requires appreciation and more creativity, I guess.
Yeah, I think historically, things are changing now. You could run to the store and get strawberries in December.
That's right.
You know, but
not that they taste very good, but
right.
Yeah.
But historically, there was always this rush. You dealt with what was in season at the time, like we were talking about the hunting and gathering. It wasn't into even the 40s and 50s that people, relatives of mine up on the reservation, were still going out and camping during the berry season or the ricing season. And they would, because your whole livelihood there in the survival in the winter depended on this, because you couldn't just jump in a car and run to
right
to the mall or the grocery store. And so there was this urgency to get all of this stuff done and preserve it as well as you can. And a big change in that was the freezers. When the freezers came along, suddenly canning became less important or less urgent, and drying things and stuff like that.
Amy, do you feel like people are coming back to that, the preserving or...
I mean, I think there's more. It's more popular. Are people really doing it more?
Right.
I don't know.
Right.
I mean, in a lot of ways, like when I'm standing in front of my boiling water bath canner, I think this is really old fashioned, and I wish I had like a steam oven. I could just like rack them in, you know. I do. I want to put up tomato sauce, and the reason I want to do it is not because I'm like trying to recreate this moment. It's because it tastes better. Yeah. You know, it tastes so much better. But I do want to get back to like the idea of thrift. Like you can't take the thrift out of Midwestern food. It's essential and totally integral to the discussion, and free things, absolutely.
We have some, I think, young people in the audience who maybe are the next generation of foodie types. Who's going back to some of these traditions for preserving and canning? Right there in the middle. Why are you doing that? Why are you interested in it?
Well, I think that Amy really hit the nail on the head talking about capturing those flavors of summer. So I have a lot of friends who are farmers or who grow food in their backyard. And there's nothing better than those first tomatoes out of the garden. So in August, I'm thinking about in January when I have no fresh food around me that I can't, that isn't coming from California or Mexico.
Right.
And I want to be able to go into my freezer or into my cupboard and take that out and relive the harvest.
Wow. Well said. Andrea, I love that idea of recapturing in the, I don't know, in the coldest, most barren time of the year, recapturing that taste and moment of all this plenty.
Well, and there is sort of the feeling of a gift when you right. when you do take something out and you say, oh, I still have a bag of these, or I still have something here. And I also love the idea that there are times that it's just you're not going to have a fresh local tomato.
Yeah.
In January. I also like that. It helps me because you can get everything all the time. And I think there's something beautiful to not getting what you want. Not getting exactly what you want all the time. I think you learn, right? You have to connect more with what is available or what should be available. And I think it allows you to be more present.
And you gain more of appreciation of what you do have when right. it is fully ripe and in season, and you appreciate it much more when you don't have.
Here's the thing about that. When you say not getting what you want, the dilemma is you can go to the store and you can buy what you think you want, which are tomatoes from California or Mexico, and they don't taste anything like what you want, right? They're right. an approximation.
They're not the same.
Right.
I think that's when, you know, people are like, oh, well, you could just get this. You can replace this jam with this homemade jam. And they underestimate the level of discernment of people. And even though, like, Midwestern food is can be kind of simple or basic.
Yeah.
And not have all these bells and whistles, what it does have is this almost Italian-like kind of discernment where people will argue about, you know, in my family, I'm like, why are they so crazy about food? And it's like they'd be arguing about, like, how much pepper we put in the bologna, you know? Like, little tiny things. But that's what people are trying to get from their summer garden right. or the farmer's market. And there is, it's kind of hard to define. It's really subtle, but it's a big flavor. Like my strawberry jam, I make it the way my grandma did. I take my strawberries, I get them from a Kendra Sicola who has a berry farm outside of Park Rapids, and they're organic and they're small and they're fragrant. And I boil them once and then put them on trays under a screen, and they evaporate in the sun.
Wow. Oh, that sounds
right?
so good.
And my grandma described this to me like when I was a child, and I was like, how does that work? But then I tried it one day and I was like, this is a miracle. You know? So now I do it. It's great.
I'm curious about whether there are people here who a recipe got passed down in your family, but nobody ever wrote it down. You just know how to make it. Yeah, right over there in the back.
First of all, Carrie, I've been a fan since Care 11 days.
Thank you. Thanks for coming.
My mom has a friend. They met when they were in the Navy on Guam back in the early 70s. And her friend was Italian and had her grandmother's recipe for spaghetti gravy.
Ah.
And it's like the best spaghetti meat sauce. And about a month or two ago, she passed through, and I was like, oh, Maria, I love this stuff. You know, I make it all the time. And I was showing her the recipe that my mom had written down. She's like, oh, that's not what we do at all. So I'm like, well, you got to tell me. She's like, well, basically, you know, you have your meat, you have your tomatoes. You can just go, you know, add any herbs and spices that you want. You can make it your own. So
is this going to transform the way you make this spaghetti gravy? You've kind of torn up the recipe card?
I pretty much have, yeah.
Wow.
Like now I do less ground beef, more spicy Italian sausage, and I braise short ribs until they're just fall apart.
Can we all come to your house?
Sure, yeah.
All right, good.
Yeah.
I'm hungry. I'm hungry right now. Thank you.
Yeah.
That's great. Do you, Bud Bruce, do you guys have food that you make that has deep history, maybe deep family history to it, and no written down recipe is needed? Can you think of a dish? Bruce,
I think most of my dishes end up being kind of onava onep, my grandma used to say.
A pinch and a handful. Okay.
Onava onep. I think potato dumplings. That would be for me, but yeah, we would have that. It's interesting how family recipes change, talking about that, because our family recipes change, and I think we should celebrate stuff, even if we can recreate stuff. I know saffron, I use saffron at Christmas time. My mother never did. She used cardamom.
Because she couldn't get it?
She didn't want to spend that much money on it.
Right.
But then I asked my auntie, who's much older than her, big family, so one of the older siblings, I said, oh, I'm making saffron bread. She said, oh, that's so good. I said, did you have that when you were young? And she said, oh, yes, and it was expensive. But my mother never had it, you see. So different ages, different things. I recreate. I use it all the time now. I think we can recreate we can draw from deep well of family stuff.
Right.
I think a simple one in our family. My mother's family was from White Earth Reservation, and we used to joke that they boiled everything. We hardly, once in a while, we'd fry something for a treat.
They boiled everything? Yeah, and frying was a treat?
Frying was a treat, yeah. So we used to talk about if somebody brought my grandma a porterhouse, it would have been chopped up and made into soup. But one thing that all my brothers and sisters still make is, and it's very simple, but my grandma would take what was available, is when cabbage came in, rutabagas and potatoes, you were digging them, then she would buy some ring bologna and we'd put it in a big pot and boil it. And
that actually sounds kind of good.
It's very good. It's comforting, but it's a simple Indian recipe. But, I mean, all my folks still like that.
I like that you use the word comforting. That's also something that Amy writes a lot about in your memoirs. What does comfort mean to you when it comes to food?
I mean, just that it tastes good and it's warm and all of that. But I think deeper, it's probably that it has some meaning.
Right.
You know? And I think that it's kind of what we're all talking about is food that has meaning. And I guess that's kind of what I mean by this, you know, nostalgic hunting and gathering thing. But, you know, going back to times when food is a little bit more scarce, so you have to take time off from your daily grind to just say, hey, this is the weekend, we're making apple cider. You know, and everybody's got
everything
to get together.
Else stops, kind of.
You
right?
have to. I mean, that's what the fall does to you up here if you're really using processing stuff. So I think that food, whatever you do as a group, and a lot of our friends get together for food parties. We do this, right. You know. Mm-hmm. Andrea and I have cut up a pig together, and we're just planning to do another. And Bruce
we're
and Bud,
we're coming back to that in just a
Bruce
minute.
Bruce and Bud do a lot of like those kinds of parties as well, and the weaving workshop also, and. I think that those times that, you know, that food has more meaning. And also, usually it has more flavor because it's, you know, so close to the time that it's ripe.
Right. We're in the Rourke Art Gallery Museum, Moorhead, Minnesota. A beautiful space. Used to be a post office. And somebody said to me, this is when they built buildings that really were built to stand. Beautiful space. We've got art around us and a live audience, and it's part of Minnesota Public Radio's 50th anniversary celebration. So we've brought the show here. We're talking about food and its connection to northern Minnesota and how the topography and the landscape here influences how we eat. Some of the nostalgic ideas we have about food, but some of the creativity, right, and the innovation that's going on with food in the Northland. Live audience, let's let them hear you guys. Yeah, okay. We have four foodies with kind of a different backgrounds and different look on this. Bud Parker is with us, retired Navy. He's a historian, has deep roots in the Native American community. Bruce Engebretson runs a craft weaving studio, grew up in the area, understands the history of food around here. Andrea Baumgardner is the chef and co-owner of Burn Bombs, and Amy Thielen is with us, a chef and a writer. Her newest memoir is titled Give a Girl a Knife. I'm going to come back out to the audience here to get you to think about something. Is there a dish that has come down to you through your family that really encompasses your family's history and the roots of your family? Like, For as far back as that goes, maybe it's Scandinavian, maybe it's Middle Eastern somehow. Anybody can, yeah, great.
Well, my roots are Sicilian and Spanish, but my husband is very Norwegian. And so, as my family says, I've become Norwegianized, and they can't quite understand it. But we just made pølse. So the whole family gathers together. It's their Norwegian sausage that they've had since his grandparents homesteaded in western North Dakota.
Oh, wow.
And so they used to grind it all by hand, put in their own seasonings, and now they have the butcher grind it because, like, we're the youngest and we're kind of old. And so they have the butcher grind it and add the seasonings, and then we get, like, I don't know, we must have had 100 pounds of meat, and then all the cousins gather together, and we either put it in patties or links. And it's like, we do it every year.
This is a family celebration around this dish.
Yes.
That is great.
The kind of getting back to the comforting food, too, is besides it being fresh and local and all this stuff that it tastes really good, is also getting back to community.
Yeah.
This is one of the things that made it so special, that you had these emotional feelings. It wasn't just the taste of the, whether it's the wild rice or the hazelnuts or the berries that you were picking or the meat, the fish. It was the whole community coming together. And sometimes it was not just relatives. It was whole neighborhoods and what, like the smelting all around the state. People used to look forward to that. But that community thing, you know, if you have 20 people go to Walmart and get a bag of potatoes, you don't have that feeling for that potatoes.
Right.
But when you're out there gathering the rice or the berries, it's just that community of being together and doing something in unison that gives you, before you even taste it, you're excited about
it. Oh, that's
it. You're
right.
Looking forward
to it. The experience is already kind of embedded in your memory.
Absolutely.
Before you even taste it. Right. Amy?
Well, and you're passing on the craft of doing things like, you know, how to make maple syrup, or I mean, those things like have to be, the skills for that have to be passed from person to person. It's a visual art, you know. You have to see it to be able to do it.
Right.
I mean, this week in my community, Two Inlets, we had a horseradish party, and you know, it's an annual party. Everybody just gets together and digs horseradish, peels it, scrapes it, grinds it. It's hot. Everybody cries. You know, like the comes down your face, but you drink wine and hang out and have a potluck.
Jeez, you can make fun out of anything, Amy, to come hang out with you. A dish, let me come back out into the audience, a dish that really, these two people that I talked to, yes, fascinating lives. They both worked, they retired to be aviation missionaries, and they spent time in Afghanistan. Is there a food tradition that you observed there that you might have brought back? Or what was your observation about work in that part of the world?
The food of Afghanistan, much like Pakistan and India, has lots of flavors to it. So
Right. We
are so happy to see some of the diversity coming into the Fargo-Moorhead area, which brings in some of that diversity in food as well. So that's been a real, real treat for us.
I'll bet you can taste something from that part of the world and be kind of instantly transported back to that experience of living there.
Oh, yeah. In fact, some of the restaurants there were amazing. And so, yes, we definitely can say that we'll taste a cumin or something. And,
right.
Oh, yeah, I remember that. We used to eat that at wherever.
This is a good point about Bruce and Bud, about the diversity of the tastes and the availability in the area. That's probably somewhat different?
Well, I think so. And I think our tastes have changed in general in the whole country. Our tastes have become very genteel. Everyone likes walleye, and I like walleye. I have walleye, but you know, walleye doesn't have that much fish tape flavor to it. Nobody really wants a boiled whitefish.
Okay,
anymore.
What are you really saying here?
Our tastes have changed. And I think I'm glad for shows like Bizarre Foods where people are trying different things. And because not that long ago, and still some people are eating boiled bullheads and or boiled fish, which tastes fishy.
Yeah.
But we like, but yeah, you see, but people grew up with fish. They things have changed in that way, and I hope I don't know what to
tell them the story about the bullhead. What is trout of the Midwest?
Oh, I grew up on a lake, Height of Land Lake, in the middle of the state or something near here. And they commercial fish bullheads like crazy. Bullheads have a skin on them. They don't have scales. They have only a skin. The flesh is pink, and it's really good, especially in the spring. Pink flesh. And someone asked them, and they tons and tons of trucks would come with fish, you know, to pick up fish. They said, well, where do you sell them to? They said, well, he said, we take them to Chicago and sell them to the Jews and call them Minnesota trout. Which is horrifying, because Jews shouldn't be eating bullheads because there's no scales on them. But they were all skinned first. I don't know if that's true or not, but
right.
It's as true as anything else you'll hear.
It's a good story, Bruce. Okay.
But some of the, like, kind of the like you're saying, but the tastes have changed. We were much less picky about what we read. But you know, my grandparents, my grandpa was born in 1885, my grandma was in 1901. When they were growing up, it literally, and not to feel, you know, make a martyrs out of them, but I mean, you were grateful to eat.
Yes.
You really were. And there were times where you had nothing. And so my grandparents raised me quite a bit. A breakfast would be milk toast. I mean, just a piece of hot toast, warm with butter on it, and warm milk poured on it, salt and pepper, and that was breakfast. You were done, and now it's time to go to work. You know, simple things. Also, like the fish head soup. I remember my grandpa's generation; those old folks, they would talk about sucker head soup.
Sounds delicious.
It is. It's actually very good. When I was a kid, I was like, ish, you know, I'm not eating that. But as I got older, then I tried it. It's like, wow, this is really good. But my grandparents' generation, when you would mention sucker head soup, we used to tease those old guys like my grandpa and say, oh, just mention it and watch that sparkle go in their eye. and then like ducks, mud hens, coots. You don't hear of people eating those anymore because they got kind of a muddy taste. But years ago, people were very happy to get a coot and beaver, muskrat. I mean, whatever was there, that's what you made do with.
You have to look back a little ways, but not too far. My family didn't experience hunger or famine in this country. I know once they said they ate white rice 3 times a day for a while, and that was hard. A cousin of Bud's from the reservation, we were talking about this show, and I said, well, and she said, yeah, onion sandwiches were so good. I said, oh, yeah, I said, with butter? And she said, no, we didn't often have butter. So thinking about that, those things are in our collective memory somewhere that we, and gathering stuff from the earth, it's there's such a religious, not religious maybe, but spiritual connection when you gather, when you find bounty, when you find the fullness of earth when it's just giving itself and it's there and it's doing that whether you're there or not. You're not, you know, and so you feel humbled by that when you're in the presence of a great wealth.
Andrea, I wanted to come back to you on what some of our audience members said about how the availability of foods is changing what we're interested in tasting. You worked in California, San Francisco, and LA. When you came back to North Dakota, did you think, oh God, I am leaving, you know, I'm coming to a desert for food diversity. And I know it's not like that anymore, but.
Well, I think, you know, it was funny because I came back and I'd worked in places on the West Coast where it's very easy to buy locally. Mm. It's very easy to get a real assortment of things all year round. And you have the ocean and you pretty much have what you want. So it doesn't take a genius to use local foods. And I came back thinking, oh, I'll just bring California here. And that's, of course, that's not local.
Because that doesn't work because, again, the offerings, the availability.
Well, and I think what I've realized is here has its own. We have there are many traditions here, many things here that are worth celebrating. Things, certainly when I think of native food traditions that I know very little about, there's like a whole plethora of things for me to learn about that will last me my lifetime right here in Moorhead. So,
it's interesting to hear you say that. There's a humility then in saying, I'm coming back from, you know, this experience and these people need that. So I'm bringing that back here with me. And then to realize you have that.
There were very kind ranchers and farmers and people who had grown things locally who schooled me.
Yeah.
They definitely were.
And you were open to that schooling.
I hope. Yeah, I hope. I mean, and I'm thankful I use a lot of the same producers to this day because it also takes, for those people, 15 years ago, it took vision to say, I'm going to do non-commodity farming, or I'm going to do small ranching. And it still takes grit.
Amy?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot to still explore here. I mean, the wild rice is amazing in this area, and nobody outside of Minnesota really knows about it. I'm always like talking about wild rice. It's brown, it's not black, you know? So that's something I feel like I really try to advocate for.
One of the things that you were doing when you were writing the new Midwestern Table is you were talking to people who have taken local ingredients and done a fair amount of experimentation. And it sounded like you were going into some of their kitchens and watching them experiment with some local ingredients. Maybe wild rice is part of that.
Yeah, I mean, learning about how it's parched and stuff like that. Yeah. And I also went to, you know, a lot of people who are raising meat. I mean, the meat around here is incredible, and people are raising great pigs and things like that and chickens, and I've learned how to kill chickens. And
what's with the pig that you two are
We're just scheming over here, trying to figure out when we're going to get this pig from an Amish farmer and cut it up in front of my woodshed. Because we did it a couple of years ago, and it was a lot of fun. And also, we learned a lot about butchering, and we're going to...
It was a lot of fun. My half of the pig was really unskillfully broken apart. I had looked at a YouTube video overnight, like... 10 times. And
and that's how you learned how you're going to...
Well, I had done it. We had seen it in school, but I hadn't worked anywhere where we had done it. And I thought, I should be able to see where all the muscles fall apart because I do smaller animals. And but I can't say that it was that skillful.
Pigs are big, a brave woman.
It's a skill.
You can get lost in a pig, let me tell you that.
Totally, you can get lost in a pig. It's bigger than you think.
And then you just label all the cuts mistakenly.
Yep.
Oh, my gosh. We're in the Rourke Art Gallery Museum, surrounded by this lovely building and paintings and photography, and we have a live audience here, and it's part of Minnesota Public Radio's 50th anniversary celebration. Thank you, audience, for coming to hang out with me. It's a foodie roundtable. We're talking about foods of the Northland and what it means to a family and a community to gather around a table and how that food defines what it means to live and work in this part of the country. I'm going to come back out into the audience. Oh, I see some students right there. Yeah, go right to them, Jeff. Yeah. Can you guys think of a food that really defines northern Minnesota or this area?
Well, definitely wild rice soup.
Good.
For me, wild rice soup started at a Subway restaurant.
Really?
I had never tried wild rice soup before, and I was amazed. And then I learned that Subway is not the best manufacturer of wild rice soup.
And could you feel these two cringing?
If you go to a lot of local restaurants, it's very amazing.
So you've become now a connoisseur of the real wild rice soup.
Yes, I worked at a bistro this summer in northern Minnesota, and one of our specialties was wild rice soup.
When it's really good, what is it? What does it taste like? How do you know this is great?
A mixture of creamy and the crunchiness of the brown wild rice.
Wow, well said. Were you guys cringing when you heard him saying he experimented with wild rice soup and
I was thrilled.
Were you?
I was absolutely thrilled because how are our Midwest food cuisine going to become something outside the big box? Or maybe we have to grab the chain restaurants into it.
Good point.
But
yes.
Yeah, I was thrilled.
Yeah.
Well, once you've made it to Subway, you've made it. I'm nothing.
We're in the canon now.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, another food that really kind of defines. Yes, ma'am, right in the front there.
I would say like lefse. I actually grew up, I was born in this area, but grew up mostly in Orlando. And when I came back here, I was like, what the heck is lefse? But it's everywhere.
Okay, what the heck? I kind of know what it is, but I wouldn't be able to define it. What
Maybe
is it?
Maybe one of the panelists would be better to define it.
Okay. I can grab that one. My mother-in-law makes wonderful lefse. She's Norwegian-American. Her family is from Norseland, Minnesota. And
Norseland.
Norseland. Okay. So lefse is like a potato tortilla, kind of, but softer and thinner. And you make it with cooked potatoes, and it's a very delicate dough. It's kind of hard to work with, but she's really good at it. You slide this you roll it out thin, and then you slide a stick beneath it and roll it up, and then you transfer it to the griddle by unrolling the stick.
Oh.
It's beautiful.
There's
process.
An art to this. I know.
It's very delicate.
What you just said about the art that goes into the making. Something kind of lost on me, but I know that people who love food, this is a deal.
There is amazing baking. I think
that amazing baking
in this baking in this area
locally.
Yes.
Because of the sort of Northern European and Scandinavians, some of the family recipes that I've tried and never succeeded with are some of the Icelandic baking recipes.
What's so complicated about them?
I don't know. I think because it's sort of a pinch of this, a pinch of that, or just make it until it's a stiff dough. And I'm just like, what's a stiff dough? And my grandmother's no longer around for me to ask her. And I don't know if she would have been clear anyhow. she just knew how to make it because she'd made it 100 million times. But I think there's a definite,
you know, a lot of the pastry is very, it's delicate. It's beautiful. Like Norwegian cookies and, I mean, Christmas around here is really awesome eating, I think. It's just really
should talk to Bruce. I mean, when I first met Bruce and Bud, I went into their kitchen and there was a mountain of something and underneath a hand-woven cloth that he'd woven. Oh. And he whipped it back.
Wow.
And there was like a mountain of breads. And they are beautiful. And they make them in this outdoor wood oven, wood-fired oven.
Yes.
And anyway, there's you know, I just want to say one thing I want you to talk about, like your baking, but there's a lot of variance in variables in flour from over the ages. Mm-hmm. And then brand to brand. And so you really have to know this stuff in your hands, like the knowledge is in your hands.
So do you guys make a bread mountain just for yourselves or?
No. And we have, I tend to overdo sometimes. And it's easy. We have detailed notes now, how many loaves of rye
really?
Bread to make and how many loaves of this. I think the baking in Northern Europe is big. And the small baking too, not just the breads, but the fatimand and the sambankles. These are things that the dough is really touchy with, how much so that they'll be tender but not crumbling apart into pieces. And of course, and the interesting irons. I'm talking Nordic stuff, but the interesting equipment that you want to have, the Krumkaka iron, the rosette, special irons to make special cookies. They put a lot of time into baking in those countries. I'm talking Nordic stuff.
I wonder
what
that's about. I mean, whether long winters, you know.
Absolutely. Well, I think the whole sacrifice. I mean, then again, I get back to spirituality. They were coming up to religious, whether they were pre-Christian, you know, the solstice is coming around Christmas time, definitely, and Santa Lucia Day, too. But, boy, they were... It was a sacrifice to put this stuff together. An old man from Norway, I did a lot of woodworking with him. He was born in the 1880s. He said when he was on the boat coming to America, he saw people putting butter on white bread. And he thought, wow, this is really something. And that was after 18. That was after 1900. That was after World War I. So this is where we came from, that putting butter on white bread was, wow, that was over the top.
But my guess is that with your family on the reservation, that in times of plenty, this was really a way to honor, again, community, what the land was giving you.
But talking about the breads again.
Yeah.
We're still,
and I think when you go back to reservation, I moved to Ponsford Pine Point in 1990 when I was an adult. So I was very much taken by how important food is to Native people, and how much it is an honor. You can honor really. I mean, feasts. They didn't necessarily call them feasts at the. Oh, they did have called them feasts, but if there was a wake, a funeral, a celebration for any kind of thing happening, a celebration. They put high value on having good food there, and it was meaningful to me.
And, yeah, and they did like just for a funeral or a different gathering or whatever, they would have people would break out whatever they had, you know, and they did
right.
did with one of the we used to. It sounds awful. We loved funerals because they used to make funeral sandwiches.
And it was, okay, what's a funeral
these sandwiches
sandwich?
Is made with potted meat or ground ring bologna, and then mayonnaise, pickles, and onion.
Yuck!
And egg, boiled
eggs.
That
was something you looked forward
and,
to.
You know, you spread it super thin. Nowadays, you have these sandwiches that are like this. No, they were just like paper thin spread on this bread. But
right.
we loved those. It was all excited. Breads they used to make. My folks, of course, everybody knows fried bread, which my grandparents never said fry bread. They always said fried bread with a D at the end.
Yeah.
And then another bread was bannock, which you don't fry.
I've read about that.
You cook that in like a skillet with very little, I don't know if they suppose you use a little grease, but not much.
Right.
And so those were really special things, and we didn't have butter usually on those. Now people like butter and brown sugar and all this other stuff on it.
I think Native America needs to be, you know, strongly represented in whatever food we get here. Fry bread, everybody knows fry bread, right? And wild rice. So really, they've got strong roots in our... Yeah.
One thing I wanted to comment on the wild rice, though, is a lot of people don't realize is every lake, the rice is different. It looks different.
I didn't know that.
And that's why when people talk about reintroducing rice to an area that's been maybe through pollution or dredging or whatever that they've wiped out, that rice more than likely will never come back the way it was because lake, so like Shovel Lake way up north, it's...
Because of the chemistry of the water?
Because of the way it developed over, it evolved over the...
Isolation.
Isolation. And so like you take rice up at Shovel Lake, way up north to, say, Mud Lake or Chippewa Lake around White Earth, it's going to be a completely different taste.
Can you taste the difference?
You can see the difference visually. Some of them are real short, some of them are real long grains, some are thin, some are fat. So a lot of people don't understand that each lake had traditionally had different rice.
Now we know. A question right over there from the audience. Yes, ma'am, or comment.
My great-aunt Sig, who's been gone many years, made phenomenal homemade potato pancakes. There was no recipe. I spent 2 to 3 summers watching her making potato pancakes.
Just to try to learn what she did?
And I got it all, finally, I thought, perfected, and all of the nieces and nephews gathered and tried my recipe and said, you nailed it.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
It was a tradition.
Good, very good.
So, and she had no written down, this was really...
just a pile of this, and she just knew by look, touch, feel. It was...
Wow.
It was an amazing recipe, and I still have it.
And you still make it. Mm. And we're coming over after the show.
Let me clean the house.
So a food that I want to hear from you that you think really exemplifies the landscape here, kind of the ideal of what it means to live in northern Minnesota. Bruce, coming to you first.
Starting with me, one food.
Yes.
I've got to say smelt. Now, because some years ago, there were many more smelt in Lake Superior than
little,
there are
what
now.
What are they? Little
well,
fish?
Well, they're a small fish. They're an invasive species from somewhere else. And they came in, and they went wild in the lake. And there were, and so, in the spring, they would spawn at each of these, going east of Duluth, each of these little rivers that run down into Lake Superior would have, and people from, I'm sure, anyone from Fargo-Moorhead goes smelting?
Does anybody still go smelting?
Remember?
Really?
Well, and years ago, people...
Wait a minute, you do now still, ma'am?
No, years
ago... used to.
You had to wait until the time was right in the morning, and they would go out, and they'd test it for you, and they'd go out and say, well, if they're going to be coming in within a half hour. And we'd go out and get all the smelt, put them in coolers. And then my husband is an elementary school teacher, and he took it to his fifth grade class. And he showed them how to do smelting and smelt, but he made one thing that he was kind of showing off, I think. He bit the head off, and the kids went home and showed their parents how to do that.
That's bad.
But anyway,
what is going on in that classroom, right?
But they learned what smelting was from up north, and then we deep fat fried them for the students and for our family.
Is that you fry them?
You fry them. And people would, up and down, when those were running, the whole shore was full of people because as far away as Detroit Lakes, and they would drive 3 or 4 hours because, and they ran at night, so there'd be bonfires along the shore.
Wow.
And
party.
All these people out there taking turns with two-man dip nets, and you had milk cans and wash tubs. And if you really were into it, like having a church dinner, they just fill the back of their pickup up with these little smelt. They're 6 inches long. You know, and then they'd come home and they'd clean and said, oh, Lord, they'd clean fish all day. Churches had fundraisers, but people, I like the story of smelt. Those days are gone.
I do, too.
Those days are gone. But I think that somebody needs to do a little pro because, boy, people had good memories of that.
Andrea, how about you? What's the food that is pretty essentially Northland? Maybe you make it.
I have to say that I can't think of one specific item, but I really think of, we have amazing wheat.
Oh.
And when we get back to the baking bread, there is fantastic bread here, fantastic home style bread.
Because of the way the wheat grows in this part of the country.
Yes.
Huh.
Yes.
And it's a harder wheat, right?
Yes.
Meaning?
Exactly.
More gluten.
Chewier.
More gluten, so it's got more, it naturally has more structure for making bread.
Okay. But how about you with the food that is, yeah.
For me, it'd be pretty simple stuff. It'd be choke cherry syrup and rhubarb sauce.
Oh, just, yummy.
Whenever we, my grandparents were in the government Indian service, and my father and mother had been in the Army, so we traveled around quite a bit. But whenever we came home, my aunt always made sure the first breakfast we had was waffles with choke cherry syrup, and then every day we had rhubarb sauce or some rhubarb dessert. But rhubarb sauce was
great.
The epitome of Minnesota to us.
Yeah. Okay, Amy.
I would say venison.
Really? Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because, you know, I live outside of Park Rapids, and it's people move to that area just to hunt, really, and, you know, to hunt all kinds of things, but deer hunting is like a holiday. It's bigger than Christmas, I think. I mean, you can skip school.
Your life is one big food party.
It
right?
gets to be sometimes. Yeah. So we do. I mean, we've had a deer camp at our house now ever since we moved back from New York. And at first, I was a little reluctant, and now I love it. It's like the greatest holiday. You know, it's kind of like a pre-Thanksgiving. I'm the camp cook.
And would you say that you can taste the landscape in the venison? You know you're in that place when you're tasting that venison from that
yes.
area.
Yes, yes. And you know, it's our woods venison's a little feral, you know. It's not corn necessarily, although I would love to plant some corn. Should I say that? I don't know. it's, you know, it's very lean, and I make a lot of it into sausage, but I also leave some cuts whole, and we'll, you know, thread it with, like, fat or lard from pig. And I also cryovac it and kind of wet age it for a long time. I take care with it, you know, and then we grill it and, you know, do like a wine sauce kind of thing.
Wow.
It's great.
It's yummy.
It's really tender. It's delicious.
Okay, taste of home. Yes, ma'am. Right there in the middle.
Okay, no one has talked about hot dishes.
That's right. Good point.
And when I grew up, you know, if we went to a potluck, it was always hot dishes, and there was so many varieties. Don't see much of that anymore.
You don't? Yeah, why?
I think you see a lot of hot dishes. I see a lot of hot dishes in Park Rapids. They're everywhere. But I think that, you know, we didn't really talk about, like, the 50s, but that was kind of a different era in Midwestern food. And, I mean, in a lot of ways, what happened was that it was an homogenization of what was happening here and in the country, but also a lot of the, you know, Joy of Cooking, the General Mills Test Kitchens, Betty Crocker, all that stuff is Minnesotan. Mm-hmm. Or, Joy of Cooking is Ohio, but it's Midwestern.
Yeah.
And so in a weird way, like, we got really, we homogenized and made these hot dishes and things with industrial food, and then we kind of put it out to the country. You know what I mean?
And the country said, thank you. Bruce, how about you? What's your favorite hot dish?
I just go back to that one my grandmother made. My grandmother, my dad's mother, she made one with, it had Chinese noodles, those chow mein noodles, and tomato soup in it, and something else. My auntie hated it, and I had an aunt who lived on the Iron Range and was an excellent cook. So to me, the Iron Range will always be like the mecca of food in Minnesota, just because we got to eat petitza and porchetta and stuff that we didn't get otherwise. But grandma was not that much of a cook, and I asked why they called it preacher's casserole, and my auntie said, I think because it's cheap.
Yeah. Do you make hot dishes at the deli?
Not that I call hot dish, but we probably do,
but it's
things that are like layered or...
Yeah.
Like Brett was talking the other day just about that someone had posted a picture of their homemade moussaka, and that's sort of hot dish, like, right?
It is.
So, right. And it looked really good, and he said, we should make this. And I thought, you're right. Should one of these days.
I think your point about the moussaka, though, is a good one. One woman's moussaka is another woman's tater tot hot dish.
Right.
You know, right? Every tradition kind of has that thing where you just put in a bunch of stuff, and it's really yummy. And
you could eat it 2 days later. Right.
Right. Right. How about you on the hot dishes?
Oh, my husband wants me to make tater tot hot dish. And I do. I do make it for them. But I'll try to gussy it up with, like, homemade potatoes and, like, you know, try to make, like, the roosty potato top, not the tater tots. And I think that they like my boys, my 10-year-old and my husband.
Yeah.
They like the real, you know, frozen tater tots. That's what they want.
Jeez.
They crisp up really nicely.
Yes, ma'am.
About the hot dish, when I came to live here more than 20 years ago, everybody was talking hot dish and everybody knew what they were talking about. And I'm going, like, what is hot dish? And so,
things
like here,
changing.
It's very, not being, you know, it's like a casserole, and they would say, no, it's a hot dish.
Yeah, what do you think the difference is between a casserole and a hot dish? Probably...
Maybe the soup, I don't know.
Ah.
But, so well, do you, everybody knows hot dish.
The casserole was the dish you brought the hot dish in.
The casserole is just the container, but the hot dish is inside.
Okay. So the food isn't the casserole, it's just the dish.
The casserole is the vessel, the hot dish is the food.
Absolutely. Yeah.
That's so true.
Everybody got that, too. Everybody. It's an inside joke, and right?
I'm right surprised over there. Nobody mentioned anything about lutefisk yet.
Oh, yeah. Lutefisk.
That's right. Which is a taste I will never understand how that becomes acquired.
I don't get it.
Horrendous, for one thing. Oh, my gosh. You know who? One of the former House speakers introduced me when I was covering the Capitol for CARE 11, introduced me to lutefisk, and it was a food experience I shall not repeat ever. Do you like it, Bud?
No, Bruce is. I had never heard of lutefisk in my life until I met this Swede Norwegian.
Yes, and I love it.
And his mother, Carolyn Ingebretsen, she always had, for the hunters, when they would come up, she'd have a big lutefisk dinner. So I would go over, I was the dishwasher, and I sampled the meatballs. And,
yeah.
But every year I would just be polite, take a bite of it. And last year, after we've been together 18 years, last year was the first year I actually took a second bite.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. Took some intestinal fortitude, it sounds like, to get there on that. Hey, I want to thank you all for coming to do this and for our audience here with the foods and the ideas that you contributed. A great chance for me to meet you and thank you. Thank you for helping us celebrate the 50th anniversary of Minnesota Public Radio. Thanks for coming to join us in Moorhead today.
We've been listening to Carrie Miller's roundtable on Northern Minnesota food traditions. It was recorded in September up in Moorhead, Minnesota, as part of Minnesota Public Radio's 50th anniversary celebration.